Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Mark Smith, President and CEO of the California Healthcare Foundation and your chair for today's program. Find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the foundation at chcf.org. This program is underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Todd Park, Chief Technology Officer of the United States. Sounds like a pretty fancy title, but there's nobody who deserves it more. Todd Park joined the federal government in 2009 as the Chief Technology Officer of the Department of Health and Human Services, where he ignited a firestorm of openness and transparency and has inspired a whole generation of not only health people, but technology people to seek answers to our healthcare problems by using technology to make more data more open, more available, more usable, more transparent, and help to make healthcare better, faster, cheaper, and more convenient. He is one of the co-founders of Athena Health, which is actually a sterling example of a company which has been able to do quite well while making the lives of doctors easier and administrating lots and lots of administrative waste and administrative costs in our system. I have to tell you, I'm not a big hero worshiper, but I am Todd Park's biggest fan. He has helped influence our foundation, was nice enough to come to Sacramento, and is now providing the inspiration for people in our state and around the country to unleash the power of technology to improve our healthcare system. It's my pleasure to introduce Todd Park.
Hello. How is everybody doing? Good morning. Good afternoon. It's wonderful to see y'all. I'm Todd Park. I'm the U.S. CTO, and it's my great pleasure today to actually speak with you for a few minutes about a cause that's actually very dear to the hearts of me and many others, which is the power of open data and open innovation to help improve health and healthcare in America. I'm going to talk to you specifically about an initiative that I was lucky enough to co-found at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services when I was CTO there 2.5 years ago, with an amazing team of folks at HHS and the Institute of Medicine. And it's called the Health Data Initiative. How many folks here have heard about the Health Data Initiative? Wow! It's actually a much larger percentage than normal. So I'll actually try to balance my talk and both actually give those of you who haven't heard about background on what it is and also give those of you who have heard about the latest and greatest updates about how it's going, because it's actually moving in many, many extraordinary directions. So the Health Data Initiative, as a fair number of you know, is an effort by the U.S. government to actually replicate successes it's had in the past with open data and open innovation, specifically inspired by the weather. So about 40 years ago, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which collects virtually all weather data in America, did something incredibly interesting. It decided to make its weather data downloadable by anybody for free in electronic form without intellectual property constraint. That then actually fueled an enormous amount of innovation outside government as people created services like the Weather Channel, weather.com, iPhone weather apps, weather insurance, and many other services that improved the lives of the American people in many ways and also created jobs and helped grow the economy. The government ran a similar play in the 1980s when it began to liberate access to something called the Global Positioning System, or GPS, which now has fueled an extraordinary array of innovations in the private sector, ranging from Foursquare on your iPhone to supertanker navigation systems, precision crop farming, and many other innovations that have not only improved the lives of the public in many ways, but actually last year alone added an estimated $90 billion in value to the American economy. So we thought that this play was quite extraordinary and said, look, can we run that play again? This time with the vast reservoirs of health-related knowledge and information sitting in the vaults of HHS. And so it's exactly what the Health Data Initiative seeks to do, to liberate data from the vaults of HHS and other agencies while rigorously protecting privacy in order to spur innovation and entrepreneurship that improves health and healthcare, helps create jobs, and grows the economy. So the ingredients in the Health Data Initiative are actually threefold. First of all, we're making brand new data available that has not been made available to the public before, while rigorously protecting privacy. Secondly, maybe less sexily, but equally importantly, there's a lot of data that HHS had made available, but in the form of books, PDFs, and static websites which were not useful to third-party developers. So we're actually taking that data and turning it into data that's actually usable by developers, liquid, machine-readable, computer-readable data that can be imported by developers into applications and services that they can then utilize and fuel with that data to produce lots of benefits for the American people. And then on top of that, on top of actually making brand new data available and actually making existing data machine-readable, liquid, and usable by developers, the third thing that we're doing may actually seem like simplest and most obvious, but in many ways actually turns out to be phenomenally important. We actually found that about 95% plus of American entrepreneurs and innovators that could turn our data into new products and services didn't really even know what the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services even does, let alone the fact that we have all this data, let alone the fact that we're trying actually to make it available to them as fuel for innovation. So we ended up having to do, which I'll talk a bit more about later in this talk, a education campaign to publicize our data to entrepreneurs who could then actually turn it into all kinds of services that could actually help people. Hackathons, meetups, and data palooza's, and I'll talk more about that sequence of events later. But the first thing I want to talk about is actually, in the context of Health Data Initiative, what kinds of data do we in fact have? What kinds of data are we actually making available? And it turns out that HHS has an extraordinary amount of data that is phenomenally useful to improving the health of American people. So it's everything from the health of our communities, so rates of smoking, obesity, access to healthy food by region around the country, data on our healthcare provider infrastructure, where are all the healthcare providers, what is their quality performance, so on and so forth, information about consumer products and services, so incredibly detailed information about drugs, about insurance, product availability by zip code, pricing, benefits, et cetera. The latest and greatest medical knowledge from the National Library of Medicine. How many of you have heard of actually Medline Plus Connect? Wow, this is an awesome crowd. I love this crowd. This is like the most erudite crowd I've ever spoken to. Awesome. Health data geeks like me. This is phenomenal. So for those of you who don't know what Medline Plus Connect is, it's this new service that the National Library of Medicine has rolled out where everyone's familiar with Medline Plus, right? This is this giant website run by the National Library of Medicine that has the latest and greatest information known to humankind about asthma, diabetes, you know, different drugs, lab tests, et cetera. So Medline Plus Connect is this amazing service where National Library of Medicine took Medline Plus and broke it down into specific chunks of content that are mapped to individual diagnosis codes, medication codes, lab test codes, and then set up a free service where any electronic health record or personal health record, any application could query Medline Plus Connect and say, look, I'm interested in knowing more about this medication, this diagnosis. Then Medline Plus Connect spits back for free a electronic patient education packet written in the language that patients can understand that beams itself back into the workflow of the electronic health record, personal health record. So it's kind of like having the National Library of Medicine translated into patient English plugged into your electronic health record for free, continuously updated. Just awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. On top of that, another type of data that's actually being liberated is called a Blue Button. How many folks have heard about Blue Button? Again, for a number of people. Okay, so for those of you who haven't heard about Blue Button, Blue Button is an initiative that was launched by the Department of Veterans Affairs in partnership with Medicare and the Department of Defense about a year and a half ago. And it was based on a very simple idea, which was veterans, members of the military, and seniors should be entitled to an electronic copy of their own information. So all Blue Button is it enables any veteran, any member of the military or their family, any senior served by Medicare to go to a website to log in, authenticate that you are who you say you are, and then essentially open an account, and then from that account hit a blue button and download a copy of your own personal health record, your own Medicare claims, et cetera. When Peter Levin, the CTO of the VA, was asked by Secretary Shinseki of the VA, well, you know, how popular do you think this is going to be, right? Peter said, well, I'm not sure, but you know what? I think that if we're a breakout hit, then maybe, you know, 25,000 veterans. Can you imagine? 1,000 would ultimately want to download a copy of their own information. Well, with very little marketing, because most people still don't know about it, a year and a half later, close to 1 million veterans, members of the military, and seniors have downloaded a copy of their own data multiple times each. So it turns out people actually do want a copy of their own data. And they're uploading it into personal health records or printing out and carrying it to them with their doctors, and it's literally helping people avoid ER visits and even saving lives. So there's just a lot of data that's actually being made available in ways that are liquid, are ways that are usable, and ways that rigorously protect privacy. And then on top of that, we found it to be critically important to not just make the data available, but to let people know it's there. so they can actually utilize it to do good. And what we've been doing to make that happen may sound very odd to you coming from the government, but it's actually something that I believe in a few years will become routine. We've been doing meetups with inventors, hackers, innovators, doctors, patients, entrepreneurs, angel investors, venture capitalists around the country to actually educate them about the data we're making available and brainstorm with them what they could do with it. We've been doing hackathons, codathons. How many of you have actually been to a hackathon or codathon? Wow, I love this audience. That's fantastic. Okay, so we've been doing codathons, right? For those of you who have not been to a codathon, it's essentially like a coding party, right? So a bunch of people get together, say doctors, patients, health experts, developers, entrepreneurs, over a weekend, right? Or even a single day at, say, Google's campus or Georgetown's campus or Berkeley's campus, and they scrub into a bunch of health data. They learn more about the health data and decide to build stuff with it and then build stuff with it over the course of, say, a single weekend. And just to give you a flavor of a couple of hackathons that happened recently, Georgetown actually did a hackathon around health data with Academy Health, a phenomenal research organization, and HHS about a year ago. And it was actually in February of last year. And I was a little bit worried about this because Georgetown said, yeah, we're going to do this health data hackathon. It's going to be great. It's going to be on a Saturday at Georgetown, 9:30 in the morning. And I was thinking to myself, wow, you know, this isn't exactly Silicon Valley. How many people are going to show up to a health data hackathon at 9:30 a.m. on a Saturday, right? And I said, you know, plus, you know, developers don't get up till noon, so who's going to show up? 125 people showed up at this health data hackathon. I have no idea where they came from, including five young people from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who you may have heard the story before, but have you heard the story about Food Oasis? Food Oasis? Okay, this is a great story. So these five kids from Pittsburgh somehow heard about this health data hackathon. They got inspired. They bought lab coats with matching insignia. It's a Team Maya. They ran in the van and drove from O'Dark 100 to D.C. To get there for the 9:30 kickoff of the hackathon. They had no background in health and healthcare at all. They just wanted to help. They wanted to use their powers for good. And so what they did at this health data hackathon was they started scrubbing the data, and they met a few of our health data experts, and they discovered this thing called food deserts. Have you heard about this phenomenon, food deserts? Right? So you look at data from the USDA, you can see vast swaths of America, where if you live in one of these areas, you do not have access to affordable, healthy food, which then creates all kinds of issues. So these kids actually didn't know that this is an intractable problem. They actually had not gotten the memo about what's impossible. And so they decided to solve the food desert problem in 8 hours. And they did so via an idea that, like all great ideas, seems incredibly obvious in retrospect, which is they did a mashup of text messaging and farmers markets, kind of a flash farmers markets app. So the way that this works, they actually built this in working prototype in 8 hours, had the idea, built a prototype in 8 hours. Essentially, they built an app called Food Oasis, where if you have access to text messaging, which virtually every American does now, including most Americans in low-income neighborhoods, you can text in the fact that you want to buy a zucchini and 8 tomatoes. Your neighbors actually do the same. Then all the orders go to a central website where food co-ops, food suppliers, farmers markets can look at the website and look at all the orders and circle the ones they're going to fulfill and hit fulfill, and it texts everyone back and says, come to St. John's Church from 12 to 5 p.m. this Saturday and I'll have your food. And apparently, because you don't need a physical store, because you know demand entirely in advance, and because within 5 hours of showing up, your entire inventory gets bought, the cost of food drops like a rock. So they actually won the hackathon with this idea. They won a couple of subsequent kind of challenge competitions with this idea. Now they've gotten so enamored with it, they've decided to spin it off as a separate venture. They've gotten backing from a major American company. They're going to beta test it in 3 American cities. And here's the thing that's the best part about this. The best part about it is that these kids, while they know nothing about health and healthcare, they're experts in something called supply chain management and consumer experience design, which healthcare needs a lot more of, by the way, right? And they work for an IDEO-style company called Maya in Pittsburgh. That's this kind of ninjutsu prince and princess outfit, right, that actually knows how to do supply chain management and consumer UX design. So I went to go visit their offices in Pittsburgh, and they got one of those rooms that's one giant whiteboard. And these kids had diagrammed down the nth level of detail how they're going to pressure test every single component in this thing until it morphed into something that was going to work. And I don't know if their original idea is actually going to be the one that works, because very rarely is that the case. But I do know one thing, that these five young people are now addicted to the idea of leveraging the power of data and IT to improve health and healthcare. I actually spent a bunch of time prior to government as a private sector entrepreneur. And there's one thing basically, one thing I learned about success in the private sector as an entrepreneur. It's the following rule. If you get the best people, you win. If you don't, it becomes substantially more difficult to win. The same thing is true of ecosystems. If we can keep attracting more and more and more of the best and brightest and most talented innovators in America to care about issues like healthcare, we will win as a country. We will solve our healthcare issues. There's no problem America has we can't invent our way out of if we really try. And the best thing about these code-a-thons and hackathons isn't so much the ideas popping out of them. It's the kids, like the kids from Pittsburgh, that they're seducing into really caring about health and healthcare, which is incredibly exciting. I'll just tell one more story of one more hackathon, code-a-thon. I was actually in Louisiana, a guest of the state government, talking about health data liberation. And its power to actually help improve health and healthcare. I wasn't sure how it was going, but then in the middle of the talk, this guy got up, Ramesh Kolaru. Anyone here know Ramesh? Phenomenal guy. He got up in the middle of the talk and said, "I am very excited. I am very excited. I'm going to host a health data hackathon in Lafayette, Louisiana, very soon. And I'd like you to come and be my guest." I said, absolutely. Absolutely. But I wasn't sure what was going to happen next. 4.5 months later, I find myself flying to Baton Rouge and then driving to Lafayette, Louisiana, to be Ramesh's guest at a health data hackathon. 300 people have converged from 18 states and as far away as Germany for a hackathon to actually utilize open data sets from the federal government, from the state and other sources, to build solutions that can actually contribute to the fight against childhood obesity. Including actually one kid who flew in from Germany. And Ramesh told me that actually when he first got this registration from Germany, he was very concerned. He actually contacted the kid and said, "You do know you have to come to Lafayette, Louisiana to be part of this hackathon." And the kid said, "Yes, I do know that, but my dream is to come to America, come to Lafayette, Louisiana, win this code-a-thon and start a company. That is what I would like to do." And Ramesh said, "Well, go for it." So this hackathon happens, right? Pickup teams get formed of doctors, nurses, patient advocates, obesity experts, and hackers. They compete over the course of 36 hours. Six startups have now actually materialized, were born out of this hackathon, including a startup that has as one of its news members, a kid from Germany, who's living a 21st century American dream. So this is what we're talking about. This is what we're talking about, right? And then actually, on top of the meetups and the hackathons, one highlight of the outreach effort to entrepreneurs and innovators has been something called our health data paloozas. How many of you have actually heard about our health data paloozas? How many of you have actually been to one? Impressive. At least a few people. Okay. So how many of the rest of you actually ever imagined that a senior government official would say the word data palooza in an official capacity, right? All right. So let alone have it be official government policy. Well, it's now official government policy to do data paloozas. And so what the heck is a data palooza, you might imagine? Well, data palooza is essentially it's a festival of awesomeness on an epic scale. There's really no other way to describe it. And what we do is actually in partnership with Institute of Medicine and other organizations like Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, et cetera, we are hosting these annual gatherings where we invite any innovator, any entrepreneur who's built something amazing with our data to help patients, consumers, doctors, employers, communities to showcase what they've done for the rest of the country. The initial data palooza, we actually convened about 90 days after kicking off the Whole Health Initiative, and there were about 20 intrepid companies and nonprofits actually presented very interesting, very powerful innovations, products and services using health data. We just actually, 2 weeks ago, convened with 20 organizations like Institute of Medicine, Robert Johnson Foundation, our 2012 Health Data Palooza, about 2.5 years after the Startup Health Data Initiative. It was in Washington Convention Center. 1,600 people converged on the Convention Center for 2 days of paloozaing. Over 242 companies and nonprofits competed in a American Idol-style process for the right to present their amazing data-fueled innovation to these 1,600 folks. It was a remarkable process where folks would actually present to panels of patients and doctors and community leaders and get scored to see who would actually make it in, who would be the 100 that would make it in. And they were extraordinary. They were services and applications to help you find the right
doctor for your family, or that help you get connected to a clinical trial you didn't know about that could save your life, or give you the latest and greatest information and coaching about how best to manage your asthma and your diabetes in partnership with your doctor or your nurse. All kinds of services that leverage the power of data to help doctors and hospitals get the latest evidence at their fingertips to deliver the best possible care to a patient, or that enable them to bring the true power of information-driven care management to bear as they seek to become medical homes or accountable care organizations, or any of these new care delivery systems that really are proactively trying to do the stitches in time that keep you out of the ER, keep you out of the hospital, keep you actually healthy. There were tools that helped journalists identify healthcare disparities in their communities and actually write stories that could help mobilize action. There were tools that helped mayors make better public policy decisions to close down food deserts and replace them with food oases. And it's impossible for me to describe the time that we have, the awesomeness that transpired. But to us, it was a really powerful living embodiment of a very important principle of the universe called Joy's Law. Have you heard about Joy's Law? Joy's Law is named after Bill Joy, who co-founded Sun Microsystems, is a famous figure in Silicon Valley. He once famously said, "No matter who you are, you have to remember that most of the smartest people in the world work for somebody else." What you think about is, of course, true, right? No matter who you are, most of the smartest people in the world work for somebody else, right? And if you really want to make a change happen, don't just have your own self, your own smart people work on something, but unleash the power of everybody else who's really smart and cares to work on something, right? So if you really want to maximize social return on taxpayer investment in data, don't just have the government and a few other people build tools with it. Have all the other people in the world who really care able to access that data as fuel to build this amazing panoply of hundreds of new services and products that help people in ways that any one organization couldn't even have imagined, let alone have built and scaled to the point where these services are already helping tens of millions of people. Tens of millions of people. And growing the economy and creating jobs. So just one story. Have you heard of iTriage? iTriage is a wonderful story. It sounds like a TV episode, but this is a true story, right? So Pete Hudson, emergency room medicine doctor in Denver, Colorado, has seen one too many patients who comes to the ER and isn't able to get the right care at the right time. So as opposed to just stewing about it, he finds a buddy of his who's conversant in tech, and they build an app called iTriage, a mobile and a web app that leverages government and other data to essentially help you as a person assess your symptoms and critically find the best local healthcare provider for you and book an appointment. It got started like 8 seconds ago, but it's been downloaded 6 million times. It averages 3 to 4 million mobile sessions a month, 5-star rating on the App Store, amazing testimonials. He hired 72 people recently. He has 33 open positions and just got bought by Aetna and is scaling across the country at accelerating speed, right? An example of how entrepreneurship and innovation plus open data equals improvements in access to care, more jobs, economic growth, healthcare improvement, all at the same time. And there are hundreds and hundreds of stories like this happening across the country. Happening across the country. And at this point, I'm happy to say it's actually out of control. It's beautifully out of control. And that's exactly where we always want it to be. Because all great innovation ecosystems are actually, by definition, out of control, right? They're beautifully chaotic. So they're self-propelled. They're decentralized. All kinds of people doing things, right, that no one person could possibly have in totality dreamed up, let alone, again, have built and scaled and have helped people. In fact, actually, we're no longer the only source of data, right? States are actually joining us, like New York and Louisiana, to make their data available. Private sector organizations are actually making their data available. And the innovation that's happening is just incredible. Incredible. In fact, actually, one just interesting stat I want to tell you is that I actually took a look at these 242-plus companies and nonprofits that submitted for the 2012 Health Data Palooza. You know, I do a lot of meetups. I do a lot of hackathons. I thought I actually knew most of what the heck was actually going on. I looked at this book of submissions, and I said, I don't know, like, 80-90% of who these people are. Who are you? Where did you come from? And I was excited by that. I was incredibly excited by that. And I looked at the founding dates of the companies, nonprofits, and I kept seeing 2012, 2011. So this is fantastic. This is really now out of control, which is exactly where we always wanted it to be. So I have never been more optimistic about the future of health and healthcare in America. It's not because I've been sitting in my office in D.C. thinking happy thoughts to myself. It's because I've been meeting more and more and more extraordinary innovators of all stripes across America who are doing incredible things, leveraging data to help patients, help nurses, help doctors, help employers, help communities improve health and healthcare while growing the economy and creating jobs at the same time. It's like an author I'm fond of quoting, William Gibson, he's a famous cyberpunk author, once said, the future is already here, it's just not ubiquitous yet. And I think that's actually 100% true. I have seen in the work of these innovators amazing innovations that hold enormous promise to improve health and healthcare in America. In fact, already are demonstrating results and just need to scale, and they're in the process of scaling at accelerating speed. This actually is an exceptionally sophisticated, erudite crowd. If you haven't already scrubbed into our health data, please do go to healthdata.gov to check out the latest resources. More and more resources are getting added all the time. If you actually have any questions about any of it, please feel free to contact me directly. My email address is tpark, T-P-A-R-K, at ostp.eop.gov. Sorry about that email address, but tpark@ostp.eop.gov. We love your feedback about the data sets. We'd love your feedback about what needs to be improved, what you actually liked, and so on and so forth. And for those of you who have heard me speak before, I have a protocol. I read all my own email, and if I don't get back to you in 72 hours, then put you idiot, colon, subject, and send the email to me again. I sort my outlook by you idiot, right? And then I get back to people. Now, Tom Getz, the executive editor of Wired Magazine, recently discovered a hack, which he's been telling everyone, which is that if you put you idiot in the first email, you save yourself about 3 days. But I'm incredibly excited by folks who are getting incredibly excited about health data and innovation. And there is someone in this room, maybe 10 people in this room, who will take health data and use it to change the world, who will invent something that no one else could imagine that will help millions of Americans improve lives, save lives, and grow our economy. And I'm obsessed, we are all obsessed, with helping you do that incredibly important work. So given this crowd, I'm sure a lot of you have actually been working with health data since long before it was cool. And for that, I thank you profusely. We thank you even more for what you're about to do. And please don't hesitate to call me an idiot and reach out to me if we can help you. As you do this incredibly important work, this innovative work, this entrepreneurial work with health data to try to improve health in our country, may the force run strongly in you. Please again let us know if we can help you. God bless you, and God bless America. Thanks so much for your time.
So our thanks to Todd Park, Chief Technology Officer of the United States, for that engaging and certainly energetic, motivating talk. I'm Dr. Michael Blum. I'm the Chief Medical Information Officer at the University of California, San Francisco, and a professor of medicine and cardiology. I'm going to be the moderator for the question and answer portion of today's program. This is really a wonderful experience for me because I kind of live at the interface between the clinical care and the technology, and it's my job to take some of these very exciting new technologies and bring them into the clinical environment, which is an environment that, as many of you know, is a fairly conservative environment when it comes to making change. So this is really a fascinating opportunity. So we have about 25 to 30 minutes, and I think I have about 6.5 hours of questions here that are all carefully arranged, and I'm going to start in this order here. So we'll start with a little bit of a softball for you to get warmed up. The first audience question is, in what ways do you see the role of the United States CTO evolving over the next decade?
Oh, it's a great question. In case it's not incredibly obvious, I continue to champion efforts like Health Data Initiative in my current role as U.S. CTO. And in fact, we are taking the notion of Health Data Initiative and the whole ethos of open data and open innovation to bodies, and we're running that play again in energy, education, safety, and other sectors. We're just huge believers in the whole idea of opening up access to public data while protecting privacy. Opening up access to that data in machine-readable, usable form, engaging innovators in it, and having them turn it into awesomeness. So that is work that we're making great progress on. It's work that will not be done, quote-unquote, anytime soon. So I expect that to be a continuing theme of the work of the U.S. CTO over the coming decade. And then more broadly, As USCTO, and I'm sure future USCTOs will do the same thing, we are on our USCTO team working very energetically with innovators both inside and outside government to come up with and execute initiatives that, similar to these open data initiatives, can really harness the power, unleash the power of data and IT to improve the well-being of the American people, grow the economy, and create jobs. And so I can get into that in a lot more detail, but that might be a little bit beyond the scope of what we're talking about here today. But in a nutshell, I think the USCTO teams going forward will continue to be obsessed with the whole idea of embracing the power of and advancing initiatives like open data, projects that can unleash and harness the power of data and tech and innovation to improve the well-being of the public and grow the economy.
Thank you. So, excellent segue into the next question, which is that Kaiser has great technology format for maintaining each patient's history. When is the rest of the medical profession going to catch up? And a related question that gets to where you were, what needs to be done to standardize and render interchangeable all hospital medical data in the U.S. for hospitals and medical centers?
Great questions. So as I'm sure a lot of folks in the audience know, there has been a large-scale public and private collaborative process underway now for several years, led by the Office of the National Coordinator of Health IT and many leading minds in the private sector to do exactly what you're just talking about, come up with consensus standards for how to actually capture and structure and make interoperable medical information, and also to make sure that that information can flow wherever the patient needs for it to go. So there's a lot of phenomenal work happening there. We could actually have an entire hour of conversation about that. But there's a lot of progress being made. Again, is it done? Of course not. But is it light years ahead of where it was even 2 years ago? Absolutely. And momentum is accelerating.
So there's this ongoing tension between the evolved electronic health records that are not open, shall we say, and a lot of the innovation that you've spoken about and that the vast majority of these questions are about, really open new approaches, new technologies. How are we going to transition from this world of very stable but more mature platforms into this open environment?
It's a great question, and I think that actually a lot of that will be driven by the ingenuity evolution of the marketplace. We see a lot of innovation happening both from brand new players and from existing players. I think X factor that is very important to talk about is this notion of patient records actually being turned from manila folders into electronic data, and then B, the ability to, protecting security and privacy, have that data again able to flow where patients need for it to go. So that is a huge focus of public-private effort today, it's progressing at an accelerating pace. And maybe it is worth kind of doubling down just in terms of conversation on that just a little bit, just to make it even more concrete. So there are three paths that are materializing for that to happen, and by that I mean the ability for patient information to flow wherever it needs for it to go, wherever patients need for it to go. So the first is what's called the Trusted Affinity Network. So this is the whole idea of essentially a group of organizations getting together and saying, look, we're going to share information seamlessly with each other. And that's actually not a technical problem. That's really a trust problem. As far as I'm most Ashari, the National Coordinator for Health IT says it will scale at the speed of trust, which can scale. again, it's really not a technology problem. It's a organization's trusting each other problem, making sure that they feel comfortable sharing information with each other. So that's actually one axis of progress. And you can see growing networks of folks across the country, providers across the country who are actually doing that. Then a second bucket of enabling patient information to go wherever it needs to go is called directed exchange. So this is the whole idea of me as a provider being able to actually send securely a package of patient information from me to, say, another provider, another entity on behalf of the patient. And this is being powered by something called the Direct Protocol. Have you all heard about this, Direct Protocol? No? So this is actually another very interesting example of Government 2.0 at work. So what happened is, it was about a year and a half ago, actually a little bit more like 2 years ago, there was a public hearing about health information exchange. And a doctor came to this hearing and said, look, y'all seem very smart, but I've got this basic problem, which is I have an electronic health record. I have another physician with whom I work frequently who has an electronic health record. In fact, we both have the same electronic health record product from the same company, right? I just don't know how to get
my patient's records from me to her. And so what I'm actually doing, because I'm not sure what else to do, is I'm printing the records, faxing them to her so her team can re-enter them into the electronic health record. He said, I can't imagine that that's what you want me to do. So he said, can you help me solve this problem, right? And HHS said, well, we can help you solve the problem. But actually, as opposed to HHS of yesteryear, which would have hired some government contractor to spend 8 years and $50 million not solving the problem, okay? HHS, in fact, did something different. It said, you know what? We don't know what the answer is, but we're confident that America actually does. So we hired this brilliant entrepreneur named Aryan Malik, who dropped everything to serve his country, opened up a wiki space online and said, anyone in America who wants to volunteer to solve this doctor's problem, you're welcome to join the team. And this open, collaborative volunteer team in 90 days came up with a consensus specification for secure healthcare email, which has now been adopted by EHR vendors representing over 95% of the industry. They've either implemented or are about to implement it by 40 different states' health information exchange networks. And it's this very simple idea, very quickly implemental, of a secure email protocol that you can use to securely send a patient's information from point A to point B. So that's the second bucket. And on top of affinity networks and directed exchange, the final bucket is what we call patient intermediated exchange, which I think actually may be the true X factor. This is a simple idea of just give the information to the patient, right, and they'll become their own walking health information exchange. It's hard to describe the momentum that Blue Button has right now. It's actually quite extraordinary. In addition to actually tens of millions of veterans, members of the military, and seniors having access to their own data downloadable to them, which they can then upload into personal health records and other applications, the private sector is actually adopting this as well. In fact, one of the questions we got after we launched Blue Button was people from the private sector calling and saying, are you allowed to do that? And we said, what do you mean? They said, well, are you allowed under the HIPAA privacy laws to let patients electronically download a copy of their own information? We said, yes. Yes, you are, right? But I think that no sub-regulatory memo we could have written was possibly as convincing as the VA, the DoD, and Medicare just doing it, right? Just doing it themselves. So now Aetna's actually done it. United's in the process of doing it. Walgreens is doing it. McKesson has done it for the patient portal they supplied to 200,000 doctors. Has now been blue-buttoned. Vermont's doing it. Indiana's doing it. In fact, we just launched a project called Blue Button for America to actually help the private sector learn more about how to implement Blue Button and help more and more Americans get access to their own data. And so that is a third axis of liquid information that goes where patients need for it to go, and that actually could end up being ultimately the most powerful of all. I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, the strategy is really all of the above, right? Advanced patient data liquidity, advanced the ability for patient information to go securely where patients need for it to go through all of the above. And we're seeing a lot of progress on all three.
So along those lines, another question of how can individual patients help open up the data, as you were saying?
Yeah.
And what would they expect to see as immediate benefit to them?
So I would say, first of all, that there is a lot of data that's actually being made available that's highly relevant to patients. Like, for example, we just deployed something called the healthcare.gov Insurance Finder API. And basically, it's a database that developers can now access that has continually updated information about the private health insurance products available by zip code across America, including detailed benefit information you can use to compare them vis-a-vis each other, including pricing information, how the pricing varies by smoking status, gender, zip code, family size, et cetera. It's now available to anybody for free to actually pull into their own products and services. There is more and more information we're making available about healthcare provider quality, which should be intensely interesting to consumers. There's information we're making available about drugs, about recalled FDA products, so on and so forth. Again, all in forms that are easy for developers to import and use in their apps and services. And so I think that, to the extent that consumers can make their voices heard and say, look, this is information we really want, this information is really useful to us, that will just help build more and more momentum behind liberating this data, which, again, is both about making it available and also making it available in usable forms. And we're seeing more and more consumer advocacy and patient advocacy organizations say, consumers need access to this information, make it easier to get, make it easier to actually put into all kinds of services and websites and products that can help people. I would also say that patients should know that they have a right to get their own data. Their own data. In fact, HHS's Office of Civil Rights just published a letter from Leon Rodriguez, the head of the office, that actually literally says, patients, you are entitled to get a copy of your own data, which any patient can actually download and then present to anyone who thinks somehow that
It's not legal to give patients their own data electronically. So I think that that's also very, very helpful as well. But here's the thing I would say kind of as a punchline. You know, all this work that we're talking about is for the benefit of patients. The patients are the customer. The patients are the most powerful ultimate force in the system. To the extent that patients can make their voices heard more and more and more, only good things will happen as a result.
So we have this very interesting ongoing discussion about giving the patients the data, because no one disagrees with what you said, absolutely. And the patients traditionally could always go to the medical records department and request their data and be given a copy of their data. But we're raising the bar on that a lot to where the patients need to, within 24 or 48 hours, get the results of laboratory tests and so on. And there was, at first discomfort of just giving out this data without having a discussion with your provider that would people be able to understand this. And I think Kaiser did lead the way in this a lot, and they just started pushing the data out, and patients appreciated having this data. But we're about to raise the bar again to patients should have access to all electronic data. They should have access to their radiology data, which is sometimes challenging to interpret, understand what you're talking about, and even more interestingly, to their pathology data, where you raise the question of a patient getting information that could be life-changing outside the context of a discussion with a provider who could explain it to them more thoroughly. Can you comment on what you see as the pluses and minuses of going down that route?
Yeah. I mean, I think that here's what I would say, and maybe this is not the way you expected me to answer the question, but let me try it this way. My daughter was born about a year ago. Beautiful, bouncing, happy, smiling little baby girl. A month after she was born, she was rushed to the hospital. I got a call from a frantic wife and went to the hospital. She had an echo done, and the echo revealed that she had a ventricular septal defect, a very large hole in her heart. In her case, it was about anywhere between 5 to 7 millimeters. I still don't know exactly how big it was, which caused exceptionally large amounts of blood to be flowing to her lungs and causing her heart rate and causing her breathing rate to go into overdrive. It is a problem that in prior eras would be a slow, painful death sentence. But in today's healthcare system, if you have insurance, if you know the right people, right, then you can actually get an open heart surgery operation that can correct the problem. Make an incredibly long story short, she had open heart surgery that corrected the problem, and she is right now, knock on wood, doing incredibly well. That was a relatively simple situation from the standpoint of care coordination, health information exchange, right? We had a consultant, we had a pediatric cardiologist, we had a pediatrician, we had a surgeon, right? Pales in comparison to, say, the 5% of Medicare beneficiaries who account for 42% of spending, who on average have 5 different diseases at the same time and see 14 different doctors a year, right? This is much less complicated than that. What I'll tell you is that even in this relatively simple situation, we found that it was critically important to get the right information at the right time in actually our hands, caregivers' hands, doctors' and nurses' hands. It should be a lot easier. It should be a lot easier. We actually found ourselves being the intermediary to get data from one place to the other, right? We wanted to get the radiological report. We wanted to get the diagnostic information, not because I was going to read it, okay, but because actually, the XYZ consultant said, actually, I'd really love to take a look at that. So we actually got it on a DVD and sent it over, right? And so I think that, we got to trust the patient, right? I mean, their incentives are pretty massively aligned in the right direction, right? I think that, if we just give them the information, their caregivers, their consultants, their doctors, their nurses will actually do the right thing with it, and it will accrue to the benefit of the patient.
Great. Thank you. So you've spoken a little bit. Another question addresses where you were speaking to the government payers and the blue button, and that we see the patients are very interested in moving forward and opening up the data. The question is, do you see a willingness from non-government private medical centers or systems to open up the data for innovation and research, given that they might have slightly misaligned incentives sometimes? And how can you speed adoption in those areas and innovation around the more conservative medical systems?
So there are a couple answers to that question. So one is, of course, under our meaningful use for health IT incentive program, criteria are emerging for that program that say that, look, if you want your bonuses for Medicare and Medicaid for the adoption of health IT and the meaningful use of health IT, you've got to be able to actually give patients their own information. But I think in parallel to that, something even more profound is that more and more providers are actually realizing that it's massively in their self-interest to do this, massively in their interest to do this. And this is actually coinciding with a shift across more and more of the provider community to these new forms of care delivery, new forms of payment, right, which move away from pay-for-volume and fee-for-service to basically pay to keep people healthy. The same kinds of incentives that, say, Kaiser or Geisinger or other leading lights have actually been operating under for some time. Just as one, again, concrete example of that, another hackathon I went to recently was, I think, the first hackathon I've ever been to that was sponsored by a medical group. So Palo Alto Medical Foundation, led by Dr. Paul Tang, a brilliant visionary, invited me to come out for a hackathon. And I thought, okay, it'll be great. It'll be like, eight doctors and eight nurses and 10 developers, and we'll have a great time together, right? So I walk into this giant room that Paul's rented, and there are like 500 people in this room, doctors and nurses and patient advocates and hackers and entrepreneurs, and Palo Alto Medical Foundation launches this giant ideathon slash challenge called the Successful Aging Challenge. And essentially what Palo Alto Medical Foundation wanted to do was spur the creation of an open social networking platform aided and abetted by access to Palo Alto Medical Foundation data, as well as other data, that would enable the elderly to age well at home. I won't go into all the details. I mean, it's because it's too exciting. And I'll just talk for endless amounts of time about it. But I just found that to be quite extraordinary. So as medical groups begin to redefine their mission from when someone shows up at my door, I'm going to do a fantastic job, to I have this population of patients, right? And I am their medical home. I am their quarterback. I am their guardian angel. And I'm going to use the power of data and technology to actually walk with them every step of the way and keep them as healthy as possible, including extending into issues which are not traditional healthcare issues like successful aging, right? I think they'll actually get very, very excited about, in fact, see no other alternative to making their data more accessible, again, protecting privacy and confidentiality, right, to patients to actually help engage those patients in their own health, help build a more transparent collaborative relationship between nurses, doctors, and patients, and ultimately deliver the best possible outcomes for patients.
So there are several things in there, right? I mean, yes. First of all, there's that Palo Alto had 500 people and Lafayette had 300, which
yep.
I'm not sure, you would figure it's not harder to get the 500 in Palo Alto, but the 300 in Lafayette really shows how amazing
yeah.
that was, right?
Yeah.
And this concept of the predictive analytics and of aging in place is getting to be a huge issue. So another question is, given the U.S. healthcare EMR or EMRs in the U.S. are getting to be online and they're getting to be more pervasive, what role do you see in predictive analytics? The question is particularly around diabetes prevention, but if you can extend that a little bit, when are we going to get to the point where we can really do prediction, help people age in place?
Oh, what a fantastic question. I love this audience. This is great. the answer to that question is up to you. It's as fast as you're going to get us there. What actually is going to happen is that access to the data will no longer be the rate-limiting step. It's actually the ability to take that data and turn it into the best possible predictive analytics that is the key to do. And this is a non-trivial question. I mean, this actually is one of the most important breakthroughs that's needed in healthcare, because if you can actually look at a patient population and predict what subset are actually going to end up being readmitted to the hospital in the next 60 days or admitted to the hospital in the next 6 months, right? That is just unbelievably valuable, because then you can go in and do the stitch in time that will save the complication, that will save ER visits, save the readmission, save the hospitalization, which is both much, 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 much better for the patient and also save society a lot of money at the same time. But the problem with predictive analytics to date, a lot of it actually, has been that it generates too many false positives, right? It's not targeted enough to actually make it truly actionable. I mean, that's probably an overly broad statement. There are very good predictive analytics at the very simple level. So there are a bunch of engines out there that, for example, will eat claims data or medical records and say, okay, this person has high blood pressure. There's no record of ever paying for a blood pressure med. So that problem, that person is actually very likely to have the problem that they're not on a blood pressure med, so go and intervene right now. So there's a bunch of kind of obvious interventions being generated by predictive analytics, but it's the next generation that's actually even more important, which is, okay, based on all this complicated stuff, right, who's going to actually end up in a world of hurt in 3 to 6 months, right? So I can go in and actually help them not end up
in a world of hurt. So this is an incredibly exciting entrepreneurial opportunity right now. And the people that actually crack the nut on this will actually find themselves at the helm of multi-billion dollar companies. It's that big of a deal because actually predictive analytics is key to unlocking a huge amount of value across the health system to actually help our docs and nurses and our health system actually do the stitches in time to actually save the complication, save the ER visit, save the admission. And just as one clue, because we're actually learning as we go along here, there was a recent survey done. I can't remember which journal, but there's a journal that did a recent survey that looked at predictive analytics to help predict the probability of readmission to a hospital. And they found that, in general, they were all relatively not so great in terms of the predictive power, with the exception of two. And two of them were determined to actually be pretty good. And the thing that differentiated the two from the others is that the others looked primarily at clinical data and claims data. The two that actually worked really well looked at social determinant data on top of claims data and clinical data. So there are interesting approaches that companies are taking, which is that on top of actually taking clinical data and claims data, they're actually beginning to do things like ask a given patient a series of, say, 3 to 5 questions that are tailored to that particular patient situation that expand the knowledge of the doctor beyond just kind of the clinical factors at stake, but the answers to which are massively important in determining whether that person is going to end up in the hospital, end up getting a complication that could have been avoided, et cetera. This is one of the most promising and necessary areas for innovation driven by health data, and there are incredibly smart people working on this right now, and they're advancing the ball on it as we speak. In fact, I see some of them in the audience.
And that's really where you get to, the rubber meets the road when you talk to making the data liquid and unlocking the data.
Yeah.
Because traditionally, we've been expanding our EHR presence, but without the ability to really extract that data in meaningful ways. Do you see that changing from the vendors themselves exposing that, or do you see that coming from the innovation on the outside?
I think it's probably a mix of both. And so what I'll say is that actually another area of tremendous innovation is where we're seeing more and more companies come in to, say, medical home networks or healthcare systems and say, you've got a bunch of different software applications. You've got lab systems, and your physician network uses 7 different EHRs. We'll provide a layer that basically sucks data out of all of them, integrates them, concatenates them, runs them through a taxonomy, and creates a longitudinal patient record that is understandable to a patient and a doctor. So advances in data extraction and analytics and transformation over the last even just 3 years have advanced to the point where actually that's a very, very doable thing. And it's proven actually in early tests to be phenomenally valuable in lots of different ways. I mean, if the patient and the physician have a truly comprehensive understand what's actually happening in a way that they understand, then better things tend to happen. These rules engines actually look at the data to try to figure out what interventions might be helpful to avoid the complication at your visit, tend to work better if the data is actually in better shape, right, and drawn from more sources, more comprehensive, et cetera. And so similarly, actually, we're seeing EHR companies begin to actually open up the data themselves, but I think it's actually kind of a combination of the two that will be where magic happens.
Thank you. So I'm going to take one moment to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today, we're speaking with Todd Park, Chief Technology Officer of the United States, who is discussing the impact of advances in technology on America's healthcare system. So I'm going to follow up on your last point with a question from the audience relating to get that quality of data that we really need to have. As we tend to move from one system to another, every time we look back at our prior data, we realize the poor quality of that data. Our clinical research colleagues always remind us that when they go and rigorously look at a lot of our data, it's not good enough to have done clinical research on, yet we're taking care of patients with it. So you talk about making patient data machine readable, yet a lot of the information is unstructured. Can you talk about specific initiatives to make more structured health data, and what have you seen that's been successful so far?
Yeah, what a wonderful question. So I would say there are at least three components to the answer. So one is that there is, as a lot of folks know here, just a lot of work happening in this public-private collaboration led by the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT to bring increased structure and robustness to clinical data in electronic health records so that it actually can be an ever better basis for everything from clinical decision support to population health analytics, et cetera.
On top of that, there actually have been a great many advances in technology in general to take unstructured data and turn it into meaningful structured data. And so there's a bunch of innovative work happening across the country on that front as well. In fact, there are actually a fair number of people that argue that, look, while you want to bring structure to certain elements of the record, there are other elements of the record that you really don't want to bring too much structure to because you might actually lose valuable information as you structure it and clean it up. So I think, again, it's important to both advance structure of the data but also actually keep certain elements in the way that the doctor actually meant to say them and then apply technologies like natural language processing to be able to extract insight from that on an ongoing basis. And the final thing I would say is that one general truth about data is it gets more useful as it actually gets used. So as the data in records ceases to be stuff that molders away in your manila folder, right, but actually becomes liquid and becomes accessible to the patient and patient's family, right, becomes accessible to other doctors, right, I think you'll find the quality of that data improving fairly significantly as it gets exercised as opposed to just moldering. And so we're already beginning to see that, and I think that's a very promising trend.
Yeah. Excellent point. So this next questioner is concerned about exactly the opposite. They said there's already an increasing and overwhelming deluge of information from consumers and in healthcare. Isn't there a risk of the problem getting worse, and how are we going to avoid the deluge getting in the way of taking care of our patients?
So I actually think we've got a deluge of data and a paucity of information, and we shouldn't confuse the two. And one of the things we actually really want to do by, for example, making data from the vaults of the government available, like data about hospital quality or community health or the latest greatest knowledge about asthma, is we want to unleash the ingenuity of innovators across the country to take that data and turn it into truly actionable information and insight in consumer-friendly services and experiences, which we are seeing happen. On a very, very broad scale. It's really not the core competency of the government, to build every single consumer-friendly tool in the universe leveraging our data, right? What we can do is take the public good that is this data about, say, hospital quality or nursing home quality and make it available to ingenious entrepreneurs and innovators across the country who can then apply their mojo, right, their experience, their expertise, their people, their technology, their capital to develop fantastic customer experiences that make that data relevant, that turn it into information in a way that again, no one organization could possibly do by itself.
Excellent. So we have a question from someone who's done that, and they've developed a small company around a product that they say is proven, and they're wondering how do they then go through the gauntlet of getting reimbursement for such a thing so that it might get adopted into the market. Any comments on that?
Well, I mean, it depends upon, of course, what the specific innovation actually is. But what I will say in general is that it's as important to innovate business models as it is to innovate the actual product. In fact, it's actually very important to do both simultaneously, and they're both kind of inextricably intertwined. So we're seeing an extraordinary amount of innovation actually on both fronts, the product and business model front simultaneously. And I think that the good news is that the overall market environment is changing pretty radically in your favor. So just to make it super concrete again, in a world that was dominated by fee-for-service payment, right, it was a very tough environment in which to introduce many innovations that improved quality, efficiency, et cetera. Because if you actually introduce an innovation that enables the patient to avoid a hospital readmission or admission, right, not only is there no business case for that, there's a negative business case because actually your customer, who is the provider, would bankrupt themselves by depriving themselves of admissions and readmissions, right? I mean, it's financial suicide. So in a world where now health systems and doctors are increasingly going to be paid to keep people healthy proactively, right, and it's no longer going to be financial suicide to actually keep people out of the ER, keep people out of the hospital, right, innovations that can actually use data to improve the quality and efficiency of care coordination, and proactive interventions actually help keep people out of the hospital, that now has a very positive business case. Now, how exactly you tap into the value created using what business model there are many, many possible choices. But you're operating in an environment where you are actually creating fundamental economic value for actors who, in some way, shape, or form, can help you monetize that value and thereby help you scale your solution.
Thank you. And so the government's been helping us out over with some of this innovation. There was recently released some wireless spectrum that was going to be dedicated to healthcare devices. And the question is, what are you seeing in the development of devices that are collecting data, specifically vital signs and other discrete data, with the patient then being sent wirelessly to various places? Can you tell us about some successes that you're seeing and where you're hopeful in that space?
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of innovation happening there, and I think that that's an area of tremendous opportunity. And again, I think it's important to think about that sector of innovation not as separate from everything else we've been talking about, but as intersected with it. And a lot of the work that we're seeing that is most exciting is when you have situations where, next generation primary care practices are extending their theater of operations, if you will, to the home, and instrumenting homes and patients with sensors that actually enable there to be a much richer real-time ongoing information-laden connection between docs and patients, particularly important actually for those who are aging, particularly important for folks who have chronic disease, and actually generating very, very exciting initial results. And again, it embedded by an overall shift in the marketplace where you are now actually supported financially for deploying that kind of technology, extending your relationship as docs to patients into their home, leveraging technology like sensors, leveraging IT, where that actually is something that is supported and funded by the market overall.
So not everyone must agree with you. So what are some of the strongest criticisms of your initiatives, and how do you respond to them?
I think that I've been struck by the range and depth of support for this general idea. The idea of actually enabling data to be free while protecting privacy and confidentiality, having entrepreneurs and innovators take that data and turn it into awesomeness, turn it into products and services that can help patients, help doctors, help communities, help employers. I think there are a number of important things to just keep in mind that are incredibly important for all of us who are passionate about this to keep in mind. One is that it's critically important to protect patient privacy and confidentiality. We've been very, very aggressive about that, and I think that's been very, very important throughout the health data liberation movement, as we've talked about. And I do believe, and there's broad support for this idea, that you can actually make data liquid, you can make data accessible to folks like patients while protecting privacy and confidentiality. I don't think that privacy and data liquidity are mutually exclusive. In fact, I think they can be quite mutually reinforcing in many ways. I think that the other thing that is important to keep in mind is, again, just continued emphasis on let the data go. Let the data be free. let patients have a copy of their own data. Let entrepreneurs and innovators get access to data like provider quality data, insurance pricing data, et cetera. One really important lesson that we learned along the way was, I don't know if I actually mentioned this already. I might have mentioned it briefly earlier, but let me touch upon it again. When we did our first health data palooza in the summer of 2010, we actually had two types of folks in the audience for the palooza at the Institute of Medicine. One was entrepreneurs and innovators who got really inspired by what these 20 entrepreneurs and innovators had done with our data and went to go build more stuff. The second was another group of people who were data owners inside HHS. Who weren't necessarily completely sold on the idea of letting the data go because they could only imagine horribleness and not awesomeness, right? But when they actually saw the awesomeness that got built with it, they said, oh, I understand, right? They saw the upside. They said, if I actually make my data accessible and machine-readable and known, then a lot of other very smart people who care just as much about healthcare as I do, who want to improve it just as much as I do, right, and who have access to resources I don't, will at no cost to me take the data and turn it into applications and services that can help people get access to the right care at the right time, can improve health literacy, can help a senior actually manage their asthma, can help a doctor manage that senior's asthma, can help a mayor make a better public policy decision and advance the ball in improving health care.
Yeah.
And so then they chose to liberate their data, inspired by that, which then fed more awesomeness, which then inspired more people to liberate their data, which then fed more awesomeness, and now we're in a virtual spiral where it's just way the heck out of control, and that's exactly where we want it to be.
It's awesome. So we're at the time in the program where we only have time for one real brief question. So I'm going to throw this one out to you from the audience again. You've described President Obama as having a high geek quotient. What have you seen from him that makes you say that, specifically with the new tech initiatives? Plus, who is the bigger geek, you or the president?
So the president is hugely enthusiastic about the power of data, tech, and innovation to improve the well-being of the country. And he is really excited about technology, not just for its own sake, but really, really excited about the power of technology to improve the lives of Americans. To help improve our health care, to help improve education outcomes, to help create jobs, help grow the economy. So he's my kind of geek. Of course, because he's the president, of course he's a bigger geek than me. A much more powerful geek than me. But what's very, very exciting is to work for a president who is so deeply, genuinely excited about the power of data, tech, and innovation to improve the future of the country. It's just an incredible honor and privilege to work for a president like that. And as you can tell, I'm having an absolute blast, as is my whole team.
Very well said. Our thanks to Todd Park, Chief Technology Officer of the United States. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program has been generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. And again, I'm Dr. Michael Blum of UCSF Medical Center. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thanks so much. That was terrific. You did a wonderful job.